Chapter 1. There is satisfactory evidence that many, professing to be original witness of the Christian miracles, passed their lives in labors, dangers, and sufferings, voluntarily undergone in attestation of the accounts which they delivered, and solely in consequence of their of belief of those accounts, and that they also submitted, from the same motives, to new rules of conduct. To support this proposition, 2 points are necessary to be made out. First, that the founder of the institution, his associates, and immediate followers acted the part which the proposition imputes to them. Secondly, that they did so in attestation of the miraculous history recorded in our scriptures, and solely in consequence of their belief of the truth of this history. Before we produce any particular testimony to the activity and sufferings which compose the subject of our first assertion, it will be proper to consider the degree of probability which the assertion derives from the nature of the case, that is, by inferences from those parts of the case which, in point of fact, are on all hands acknowledged. First, then, the Christian religion exists, and therefore by some means or other was established. Now it either owes the principle of its establishment, or its first publication, to the activity of the person who was the founder of the institution, and of those who were joined with him in the undertaking, or we are driven upon the strange supposition that although they might lie by, others would take it up. Although they were quiet and silent, other persons busied themselves in the success and propagation of their story. This is perfectly incredible. To me it appears little less than certain that if the first announcing of the religion by the founder had not been followed up by the zeal and industry of his immediate disciples, the attempt must have expired in its birth. Then, as to the kind and degree of exertion which was employed, and the mode of life to which these persons submitted, we reasonably suppose it to be like that which we observe in all others who voluntarily become missionaries of a new faith. Frequent, earnest, and laborious preaching, constantly conversing with religious persons upon religion, a sequestration from the common pleasures, engagements, and varieties of life, and an addiction to one serious object, compose the habits of such men. I do not say that this mode of life is without enjoyment, but I say that the enjoyment springs from sincerity. With a consciousness at the bottom of hollowness and falsehood, the fatigue and restraint would become insupportable. I am apt to believe that very few hypocrites engage in these undertakings, or, however, persist in them long. Ordinarily speaking, nothing can overcome the indolence of mankind, the love which is natural to most tempers of cheerful society and cheerful scenes, or the desire, which is common to all, of personal ease and freedom, but conviction. Secondly, it is also highly probable, from the nature of the case, that the propagation of the new religion was attended with difficulty and danger. As addressed to the Jews, it was a system adverse, not only to their habitual opinions, but to those opinions upon which their hopes, their partialities, their pride, their consolation was founded. This people, with or without reason, had worked themselves into a persuasion that some signal and greatly advantageous change was to be effected in the condition of their country by the agency of a long-promised messenger from heaven. The rulers of the Jews, their leading sect, their priesthood, had been the authors of this persuasion to the common people. So that it was not merely the conjecture of theoretical divines or the secret expectation of a few recluse devotees, but it was become the popular hope and passion, and, like all popular opinions, undoubting and impatient of contradiction. They clung to this hope under every misfortune of their country, and with more tenacity as their dangers and calamities increased. To find, therefore, that expectations so gratifying were to be worse than disappointed, that they were to end in the diffusion of a mild, unambitious religion, which, instead of victories and triumphs, instead of exalting their nation and institution above the rest of the world, was to advance those whom they despised to an equality with themselves. In those very points of comparison in which they most valued their own distinction, could be no very pleasing discovery to a Jewish mind, nor could the messengers of such intelligence expect to be well received or easily credited. The doctrine was equally harsh and novel. The extending of the kingdom of God to those who did not conform to the law of Moses was a notion that had never before, entered into the thoughts of a Jew.
Perere burat oriento toto vedus et contans opinio, esse infatis, ut eo tempore Judea perfecti rerum potir sader, sweeten, Vespasian.
Cap tuerno fraud. Pluribus persuasio inerat, antiquis sacerdotum literis continere, eo ipso tempore fore, ut vale secret oriens, perfectic Judea rerum potirentur, tacit, History Library Volume Chapter 913. The character of the new institution was, in other respects also, ungrateful to Jewish habits and principles. Their own religion was in a high degree technical. Even the enlightened Jew placed a great deal of stress upon the ceremonies of his law, saw in them a great deal of virtue and efficacy. The gross and vulgar had scarcely anything else, and the hypocritical and ostentatious magnified them above measure as being the instruments of their own reputation and influence. The Christian scheme, without formally repealing the Levitical code, lowered its estimation extremely. In the place of strictness and zeal in performing the observances which that code prescribed or which tradition had added to it, the new sect preached up faith, well-regulated affections, inward purity, and moral rectitude of disposition as the true ground, on the part of the worshipper, of merit and acceptance with God. This, however rational it may appear, or recommending to us at present, did not by any means facilitate the plan then. On the contrary, to disparage those qualities which the highest characters in the country valued themselves most upon was a sure way of making powerful enemies. As if the frustration of the national hope was not enough, the long-esteemed merit of ritual zeal and punctuality was to be decried, and that by Jews preaching to Jews. The ruling party at Jerusalem had just before crucified the founder of the religion. That is a fact which will not be disputed. They, therefore, who stood forth to preach the religion, must necessarily reproach these rulers with an execution which they could not but represent as an unjust and cruel murder. This would not render their office more easy or their situation more safe. With regard to the interference of the Roman government which was then established in Judea, I should not expect that, despising as it did the religion of the country, it would, if left to itself, animadvert, either with much vigilance or much severity, upon the schisms and controversies which arose within it. Yet there was that in Christianity which might easily afford a handle of accusation with a jealous government. The Christians avowed an unqualified obedience to a new master. They avowed also that he was the person who had been foretold to the Jews under the suspected title of king. The spiritual nature of this kingdom, the consistency of this obedience with civil subjection, were distinctions too refined to be entertained by a Roman president who viewed the business at a great distance or through the medium of very hostile representations. Our histories accordingly inform us that this was the turn which the enemies of Jesus gave to his character and pretensions in their remonstrances with Pontius Pilate. And Justin Martyr, about 100 years afterwards, complains that the same mistake prevailed in his time. Yea, having heard that we are waiting for a kingdom, suppose without distinguishing that we mean a human kingdom, when in truth we speak of that which is with God. And it was undoubtedly a natural source of calumny and misconstruction. Appear Ima, page 1, edition Thurl. The preachers of Christianity had, therefore, to contend with prejudice backed by power. They had to come forward to a disappointed people, to a priesthood possessing a considerable share of municipal authority and actuated by strong motives of opposition and resentment. And they had to do this under a foreign government to whose favor they made no pretensions and which was constantly surrounded by their enemies. The well-known, because the experienced, fate of reformers, whenever the Reformation subverts some reigning opinion and does not proceed upon a change that has already taken place in the sentiments of a country, will not allow, much less lead us to suppose, that the first propagators of Christianity at Jerusalem and in Judea, under the difficulties and the enemies they had to contend with, and entirely destitute as they were of force, authority, or protection, could execute their mission with personal ease and safety. Let us next inquire, what might reasonably be expected by the preachers of Christianity when they turned themselves to the heathen public? Now, the first thing that strikes us is that the religion they carried with them was exclusive. It denied without reserve the truth of every article of heathen mythology, the existence of every object of their worship. It accepted no compromise, it admitted no comprehension. It must prevail, if it prevailed at all, by the overthrow of every statue, altar, and temple in the world. It will not easily be credited that a design, so bold as this was, could in any age be attempted to be carried into execution with impunity. For it ought to be considered that this was not setting forth or magnifying the character and worship of some new competitor for a place in the pantheon, whose pretensions might he discussed or asserted without questioning the reality of any others. It was pronouncing all other gods to be false and all other worship vain. From the facility with which the polytheism of ancient nations admitted new objects of worship into the number of their acknowledged divinities, or the patience with which they might entertain proposals of this kind, we can argue nothing as to their toleration of a system, or of the publishers and active propagators of a system, which swept away the very foundation of the existing establishment. The one was nothing more than what it would be, in popish countries, to add a saint to the calendar. The other was to abolish and tread underfoot the calendar itself. Secondly, it ought also to be considered that this was not the case of philosophers propounding in their books or in their schools doubts concerning the truth of the popular creed or even avowing their disbelief of it. These philosophers did not go about from place to place to collect proselytes from amongst the common people, to form in the heart of the country societies professing their tenets, to provide for the order, instruction, and permanency of these societies. Nor did they enjoin their followers to withdraw themselves from the public worship of the temples or refuse a compliance with rites instituted by the laws. These things are what the Christians did, and what the philosophers did not, and in these consisted the activity and danger of the enterprise. The best of the ancient philosophers, Plato, Cicero, and Epictetus, allowed, or rather enjoined, men to worship the gods of the country and in the established form. See passages to this purpose collected from their works by Dr. Clark, Natural and Revealed Religion, page 10d. V. Except Socrates, they all thought it wiser to comply with the laws than to contend. Thirdly, it ought also to be considered that this danger proceeded not merely from solemn acts and public resolutions of the state, but from sudden bursts of violence at particular places, from the license of the populace, the rashness of some magistrates, and negligence of others, from the influence and instigation of interested adversaries, and, in general, from the variety and warmth of opinion which an errand so novel and extraordinary could not fail of exciting. I can conceive that the teachers of Christianity might both fear and suffer much from these causes, without any general persecution being denounced against them by imperial authority. Some length of time, I should suppose, might pass before the vast machine of the Roman Empire would be put in motion, or its attention be obtained to religious controversy. But during that time, a great deal of ill usage might be endured by a set of friendless, unprotected travelers, telling men, wherever they came, that the religion of their ancestors, the religion in which they had been brought up, the religion of the state and of the magistrate, the rites which they frequented, the pomp which they admired, was throughout a system of folly and delusion. Nor do I think that the teachers of Christianity would find protection in that general disbelief of the popular theology, which is supposed to have prevailed amongst the intelligent part of the heathen public. It is by no means true that unbelievers are usually tolerant. They are not disposed, and why should they, to endanger the present state of things by suffering a religion of which they believe nothing to be disturbed by another of which they believe as little. They are ready themselves to conform to anything, and are oftentimes amongst the foremost to procure conformity from others by any method which they think likely to be efficacious. When was ever a change of religion patronized by infidels? How little, notwithstanding the reigning skepticism and the magnified liberality of that age, the true principles of toleration were understood by the wisest men amongst them, may be gathered from two eminent and uncontested examples. The younger Pliny, polished as he was by all the literature of that soft and elegant period, could gravely pronounce this monstrous judgment. Those who persisted in declaring themselves Christians, I ordered to be led away to punishment, i.e., to execution, for I did not doubt, whatever it was that they confessed, that contumacy and inflexible obstinacy ought to be punished. His master Trajan, a mild and accomplished prince, went nevertheless no further in his sentiments of moderation and equity than what appears in the following rescript. The Christians are not to be sought for, but if any are brought before you and convicted, they are to be punished. And this direction he gives after it had been reported to him by his own president, that by the most strict examination nothing could be discovered in the principles of these persons, but a bad and excessive superstition, accompanied, it seems, with an oath or mutual federation, to allow themselves in no crime or immoral conduct whatever. The truth is, the ancient heathens considered religion entirely as an affair of state, as much under the tuition of the magistrate as any other part of the police. The religion of that age was not merely allied to the state, it was incorporated into it. Many of its offices were administered by the magistrate. Its titles of pontiffs, augurs, and flamens were borne by senators, consuls, and generals. Without discussing, therefore, the truth of the theology, they resented every affront put upon the established worship as a direct opposition to the authority of government. Add to which that the religious systems of those times, however ill supported by evidence, had been long established. The ancient religion of a country has always many votaries, and sometimes not the fewer, because its origin is hidden in remoteness and obscurity. Men have a natural veneration for antiquity, especially in matters of religion. What Tacitus says of the Jewish was more applicable to the heathen establishment. Hae ritus, quoquo modo inducti, antiquitat defenduntur. It was also a splendid and sumptuous worship. It had its priesthood, its endowments, its temples. Statuary, painting, architecture, and music contributed their effect to its ornament and magnificence. It abounded in festival shows and solemnities, to which the common people are greatly addicted, and which were of a nature to engage them much more than anything of that sort among us. These things would retain great numbers on its side by the fascination of spectacle and pomp, as well as interest many in its preservation by the advantage which they drew from it. It was, moreover, interwoven, as Mr. Gibbon rightly represents it, with every circumstance of business or pleasure, of public or private life, with all the offices and amusements of society. On the due celebration also of its rites, the people were taught to believe, and did believe, that the prosperity of their country in a great measure depended. I am willing to accept the account of the matter which is given by Mr. Gibbon. The various modes of worship which prevailed in the Roman world were all considered by the people as equally true, by the philosopher as equally false, and by the magistrate as equally useful. And I would ask from which of these three classes of men were the Christian missionaries to look for protection or impunity? Could they expect it from the people, whose acknowledged confidence in the public religion they subverted from its foundation? From the philosopher who, considering all religious as equally false, would of course rank theirs among the number, with the addition of regarding them as busy and troublesome zealots? Or from the magistrate, who, satisfied with the utility of the subsisting religion, would not be likely to countenance a spirit of proselytism and innovation, a system which declared war against every other, and which, if it prevailed, must end in a total rupture of public opinion, an upstart religion, in a word, which was not content with its own authority, but must disgrace all the settled religions of the world. It was not to be imagined that he would endure with patience that the religion of the emperor and of the state should be calumniated and borne down by a company of superstitious and despicable Jews. Lastly, the nature of the case affords a strong proof that the original teachers of Christianity, in consequence of their new profession, entered upon a new and singular course of life. We may be allowed to presume that the institution which they preached to others they conformed to in their own persons, because this is no more than what every teacher of a new religion both does and must do in order to obtain either proselytes or hearers. The change which this would produce was very considerable. It is a change which we do not easily estimate, because ourselves and all about us being habituated to the institutions from our infancy, it is what we neither experience nor observe. After men became Christians, much of their time was spent in prayer and devotion, in religious meetings, in celebrating the Eucharist, in conferences, in exhortations, in preaching, in an affectionate intercourse with one another, and correspondence with other societies. Perhaps their mode of life, in its form and habit, was not very unlike the Unitas Fratrum or the modern Methodists. Think then what it was to become such at Corinth, at Ephesus, at Antioch, or even at Jerusalem. How new, how alien from all their former habits and ideas, and from those of everybody about them. What a revolution there must have been of opinions and prejudices to bring the matter to this. We know what the precepts of the religion are, how pure, how benevolent, how disinterested a conduct they enjoin, and that this purity and benevolence are extended to the very thoughts and affections. We are not, perhaps, at liberty to take for granted that the lives of the preachers of Christianity were as perfect as their lessons, but we are entitled to contend that the observable part of their behavior must have agreed in a great measure with the duties which they taught. There was, therefore, which is all that we assert, a course of life pursued by them, different from that which they before led. And this is of great importance. Men are brought to anything almost sooner than to change their habit of life, especially when the change is either inconvenient or made against the force of natural inclination or with the loss of accustomed indulgences. It is the most difficult of all things to convert men from vicious habits to virtuous ones, as everyone may judge from what he feels in himself as well as from what he sees in others. It is almost like making men over again. Hartley's Essays on Man, page 10. Left then to myself, and without any more information than a knowledge of the existence of the religion, of the general story upon which it is founded, and that no act of power, force, and authority was concerned in its first success, I should conclude, from the very nature and exigency of the case, that the author of the religion, during his life, and his immediate disciples after his death, exerted themselves in spreading and publishing the institution throughout the country in which it began and into which it was first carried, that in the prosecution of this purpose they underwent the labors and troubles which we observe the propagators of new sects to undergo, that the attempt must necessarily have also been in a high degree dangerous, that from the subject of the mission, compared with the fixed opinions and prejudices of those to whom the missionaries were to address themselves, they could hardly fail of encountering strong and frequent opposition. That, by the hand of government, as well as from the sudden fury and unbridled license of the people, they would oftentimes experience injurious and cruel treatment. That, at any rate, they must have always had so much too. Fear for their personal safety, as to have passed their lives in a state of constant peril and anxiety. And lastly, that their mode of life and conduct, visibly at least, corresponded with the institution which they delivered, and so far was both new and required continual self-denial.